Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out for more new to you styles. I will admit I was a little skeptical at first because I'm not the type of person who dresses up very often, but you guys, this is actually so perfect and I'm genuinely so excited about this new membership with Armoire. And I want to tell you what the process was like for me. I got onto their website and I mean, there were so much to choose from. I ended up choosing 6 items and I was kind of like, we'll see what happens, you know, not sure how they were going to arrive, if they were going to be like noticeably used or what. But listen, 2 days after I placed my like case order, it showed up on my doorstep. Everything was like, when I pulled it out of the bag, everything was neatly folded and then tied up in this really pretty little bow. And I got so excited. I'm actually taking a trip to Dallas with my daughter soon, so I'm gonna wear an outfit for that. Austin and I are gonna go to a Teddy Swims concert, so I got an outfit for that. I'm like, you guys, I'm so excited about this because everything showed up in great condition. I mean, I think it looks brand new. And it's $900 worth of clothes that I'm renting for less than $100. And the best part for me is that I can just send it back. I don't typically dress up that often, but this is so perfect for like the random occasions that I do dress up without having to go and like splurge on an entire new outfit that I might only wear once. I will be honest, I feel guilty that over half of my closet has only been worn once, if at all. And there are even a few items that are going to Goodwill with the tags on them. So I love being on trend and having new things to wear, but I hate the waste that I'm creating when I do that, right? So Armoire allows me to rent these high quality designer clothes for any occasion and then just send it back. If you've got a wedding or a job interview or just like anything that you just want to kind of dress up a little bit. But the nice thing is they also have athleisure. So I got this really cute Kate Spade anorak jacket that I can wear with like a pair of leggings, and it just kind of makes you feel a little more dressed up while you're still dressed down. I also got some really cool floral wide leg pants from Steve Madden with this really cute denim halter like front vest top to go with it. And just in case that doesn't work out, I got another option too to go with the pants, and then I can have like kind of 2 outfits in one. You guys, I cannot tell you enough how excited I am about this. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Please try Armoire today. And if you do, tag me in the pictures of your outfits so I can get some inspiration and kind of see what y'all are getting. But this is so fun. I'm really, really excited about this. Thanks again to Armoire for sponsoring today's episode. And now back to the story.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see what you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon's Blink Video Doorbell. Get more at your door with the easy-to-install Blink Video Doorbell. Get more connections.
Hey, I'm here for our first date.
More deliveries.
Hi, I have tacos for two.
Oh, thanks. We'll be right down. And more memories.
Babe, come down. I have a surprise.
All new Blink Video doorbell with 2-year battery, head-to-toe HD view, and simple setup. Shop now at Amazon.com/Blink for just $69.99.
When life brings the blah, add more Yabba Dabba Doo with some tasty Fruity Pebbles. Early morning meeting, blah. Someone brought the pebbles? Yabba Dabba Doo. Run errands, blah. Head to the store for pebbles. Yabba Dabba Doo. Fruity Pebbles, less blah, more Yabba Dabba Doo. Pick up Pebbles cereal today. Yabba Dabba Doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is going to be a little bit different because I'm going to be covering the Delphi trial. So if you are familiar with this case, then you know that the trial for the Delphi murders started last week. Richard Allen has been arrested and is accused of murdering Libby German and Abigail Williams on February 13th of 2017 after encountering them on a bridge and then famously telling them to go down the hill when Liberty had the frame of mind to open up her phone and actually record the person who was telling them to go down the hill. So this case has been very widely known and very extensively covered. So if you do need to refamiliarize yourself with this story, I do have an episode on it. There's also a ton of content out there on podcasts and YouTube channels. And I think there's even been like mainstream media dedicated to this case. So as I cover this, it's going to be pretty unscripted. Usually I like to kind of write things out nicely and tie it up with a nice little bow. This is not going to be like that, but I am going to do my best to keep everything organized and chronological so that you don't miss anything. And also, before I get started, I do want to make you all aware that this trial is not being publicized or recorded or anything anywhere. So any kind of information you're getting from what's happening inside the courtroom is coming from handwritten notes from people who are inside the courtroom. There's no video, there's no audio recording. So you're really depending on people's accounts that are actually inside the courtroom. So I've pulled together multiple sources, but I am often going to be quoting directly from these sources just so that I don't mince words. And just for the sake of fluency and redundancy, I'm probably not going to say every time I'm actually quoting from another source, but I will include the sources in my description notes for this episode if you want to see them yourself. I do find it kind of wild, though, that a trial of this magnitude and a trial that is this high profile is not being broadcast or recorded whatsoever. As far as like any kind of audio recording or video recording, there's no media allowed to actually broadcast what is going on in the courtroom. And that's just not what we're kind of used to seeing these days. These days, they're all live streamed practically on Court TV and Long Crime and wherever else you can get it. But not in this case. In fact, there's even walls, like a tunnel essentially, that's been constructed outside of the courtroom or the courthouse where witnesses are expected to walk through that are expected to testify. So anyone who is outside the courtroom has no idea who's walking in, who is expected to testify on what day. Even the jurors are being sequestered, which I think is always kind of an interesting move, especially with a case that is expected to last at least a month. These 16 jurors, four of them are alternates. So there's 12 jurors. They're all being holed up in a hotel somewhere near Delphi, and they're being shuttled from the hotel to the courthouse every single day. And Judge Francis Gull basically said that every day or every week will run from 9 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday and then 9 to noon on Saturdays. And so she really wants to get this trial going, keep it efficient, and keep it moving. But I do think it's interesting that these jurors being sequestered, they are not allowed to access their phones, any kind of laptops, any kind of tablets, even their phone calls to call home are monitored by bailiffs. What they watch on TV is monitored. They're not allowed to look into or discuss this case, which that's normal whether you're sequestered or not. You're not supposed to talk about the case until after a verdict has been reached and read. But I just find it very interesting that Halloween and the election are coming up, and the judge ordered them all to get their votes in before trial started, because after that, you're not going to be allowed to vote. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. And I think about the people who are on the jury who might have families or children, and they're not allowed to see them or talk to them really without supervision. They can't go trick or treating. I don't know. I just think that's so wild. And as much as I love the opportunity to be a juror on a trial, I would probably actually be pretty upset about that. So anyway, without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get into the opening statements. Friday, October 18th was the first official day of the trial where Nick McClelland, who is the prosecuting attorney for Carroll County, gave his opening statements. So according to notes that were taken within the courtroom, Nick McClelland tried to start his opening statements with a video, but he couldn't get the video to work. They tried messing with it for about 5 minutes before he finally just gave up on the idea. So I don't know if that video was of the video captured by Libby's cell phone of the guy walking on the bridge. But after they gave up on the video, he basically gave a recap of the mini opening where he told the jury that this case is about three things: a bullet, the bridge guy, in quotes, and the brutal murder of two girls. And now the jury will hear the rest of the story. So he started out by saying February 13th was an unseasonably warm day and the girls were off of school. So they asked Libby's older sister, Kelsey, if she wanted to go to the bridge with them, but she had to work. And so Kelsey instead drove the girls to the trail and dropped them off. On the way there, Libby was in the front seat and Abby was in the back seat. And Libby took a selfie in the car on the way to the trails. And this photo was shown to the jury. This photo was like a close-up, kind of zoomed in of Libby's face. Then Kelsey dropped them off at the Mears parking lot. Now, Abby did not have a phone, but Libby did have a phone. And Libby's phone was set up so that Abby could open it with her fingerprint. So you can actually set up multiple fingerprints for an iPhone. And so that was how Abby was able to access this phone. So while they were out walking, Libby took a photo of Abby on the bridge and posted it to Snapchat. We've all seen this photo. She's wearing the blue jeans, a maroon shirt, and then a gray zip-up hoodie on top of that. Libby made it to the other end of the bridge first and looked back and saw that there was a man following Abby. So Libby decided to start recording on her phone. And that is when she got the video and the audio recording of the man telling them to go down the hill. The girls, out of fear, complied, and the video then cuts off. So later that day, when the girls were expected to be picked up at a certain location and they weren't there, that is when the search ensued. And the search actually lasted until about 2 a.m. and then resumed the next day, which would have been Valentine's Day, at about 6 a.m. The girls were finally found that day at around noon. Libby was found completely nude, covered in blood. Her throat was cut in several places. There was also a lot of blood on the ground, and then there was blood on a nearby tree. Abby was wearing her own underwear and her own shoe, but no socks, and she was wearing Libby's shirt and Libby's jeans. And then the rest of the girls' clothes were found in Deer Creek, which was nearby. But except for one shoe and then Libby's phone, which were both found underneath Abby's body. There was also an unspent .40 caliber Winchester bullet laying on the ground between the two girls. And I want to emphasize that this was an unspent, unshot bullet. Libby's phone was taken in for processing, and they recovered the photos and the video of the bridge guy. And after that, witnesses began to come forward. There were three girls on the trail who took a photo on a bench that was located east of the Freedom Bridge, which is a different bridge on the trail. And those girls apparently ran into an unfriendly man who was walking with a purpose that day. And the state is alleging that that man is the bridge guy. The state also brings up witnesses like Betsy Blair, who said that she saw a man on a platform of the bridge who was also bridge guy. And then another witness, Sarah Carbaugh, who said that she saw a man walking on the side of the road, which was County Road 300, looking like he had just slaughtered a pig, and that this is also bridge guy. Now, this is according to the state, so bear with me because I know that there are discrepancies, but I'm only quoting what the state's opening statements said. Now, years passed, and they apparently reviewed an old report of a DNR, or Department of Natural Resources, officer who interviewed Richard Allen in 2017. And Richard at the time said that he arrived at the trails at 1:30 that day and left at 3:30. and that during his time there, he ran into three girls. Now, this person thought that the person who took the report thought that if they found the three girls, then he would have to be the bridge guy. And so they called Richard Allen to interview him again in 2022, and he said he was wearing a blue or black Carhartt jacket and jeans that day, which is exactly what the bridge guy was wearing. They searched his home, and they found a .40 caliber gun, the clothes that he said he was wearing, and some knives. They tested the bullet and determined that it came from Richard Allen's gun. They interviewed Richard Allen again, and when he had no explanation for how his bullet apparently got to the crime scene, he was then arrested. While he was incarcerated, he was apparently kept in solitary confinement for his own safety. And while he was incarcerated, he told investigators what they apparently already knew, which was that he killed Abby and Libby, and he gave details like how and why, which we have not heard that testimony yet. But these were not confessions from an interrogation. These were volunteered and spontaneous, and they contained, apparently, details that only the killer would know. The state wants to emphasize that the killer hid in plain sight for 5 years and that his motive was that he was going to have his way with them, but he was interrupted, and then he forced them to cross the stream, the creek where their clothes were eventually found, and killed them. So just to give you a visual of exactly what we're talking about here, the Monon High Bridge is very, very tall. It's an old rickety bridge. I think it's been revamped since 2017, but at the time it was very old. There was no railings on either side, and there were also missing railroad ties on the bridge that you would have to step over. So it's a terrifying bridge to cross over, but at the end of the bridge, there is a hill, and as you go down the hill, you come across this pathway that cars can drive on, and it's apparently part of a private driveway, and we'll get to that. But then there's also a creek, and this is Deer Creek. You have to cross that creek to end up in another wooded area, which is where the girls were eventually found. All right, so let's move on to the defense's opening statement. Andrew Baldwin, who was one of the defense attorneys, is the one who gave this opening statement, and he started out by saying Richard Allen is completely innocent and that there will be reasonable doubt from the evidence and from the lack of evidence. So he asked the jury to wait. He tells the jury that the investigation was messed up from the beginning and up to as recently as the last few days when we heard that a hair was found wrapped and intertwined with Abby's fingers in her hand. So he says in the beginning, evidence was lost. Key witness interviews were gone, erased forever. They didn't even write down the names of the people they were interviewing, and that there was no way to recreate some of those early investigative steps that law enforcement took. And that months later, they lost even more interviews from a period of time between April 29th through June 2nd of 2017. He also says that in the middle of the investigation, the ISP, or the Indiana State Police, got into a turf war with the FBI, who was assisting in the case, and essentially kicked them out. The FBI assisted with the extraction of Libby's phone data, and police apparently kicked the FBI out before ever discussing what the FBI found from that extraction. And then, of course, as of 2 days ago, law enforcement is now scrambling because there's that hair that was found in Abby's hand. It was wrapped around her fingers and had a root. Now, I have heard different reports. Some people say that it was one hair. Some people are saying it was multiple. I haven't been able to decipher what's true. But what I do know is that DNA was extracted from the hair and that the analyst testified that the hair might be from a relative of Libby, but that it's not Libby's hair and it's not Abby's hair. It is a female hair, and they still need to complete the testing. So they're going to test the mom, grandma, sister, somebody like that to be able to tell if it's a family member of Libby's or someone else's. But regardless, the defense points out that law enforcement has had Becky and Kelsey's DNA for 7 years. They've had this DNA to see if it matches. They've never tested anyone's DNA against this strand of hair. And so we do not have the results back yet, but we're hoping to soon, hopefully before this trial is over, obviously. But then he moves on to say that the data from the phone is going to be incredibly important and that truth can come out on a phone, which is part of the defense's ultimate theme. He says, quote, forensic data on phones doesn't lie or cheat, end quote. And that when you find out what is actually on Libby's phone, the state's case is going to fall apart. He also asked the jury to hold the state to their theory of the case because he contends that they're going to have to change it as evidence comes out. And the state's theory is that Abby and Libby were dead by 4 p.m. at the latest on February 13th, that they do not move, the phone doesn't move, they are killed and then left there in that place, and that the phone was under Abby's body the entire time from about 3:30 to 4 p.m. until they were discovered around noon the following day. That is the state's theory. The state also says Richard Allen arrived and parked at the CPS lot around 1:30 p.m. before he entered onto the trail. Now, the route the state claims he took is odd, and there's no good reason to take that route, that he drove in an abnormal way. And according to the state, the car is parked there until sometime after 4 p.m. when Richard left. Once Richard left, he did not come back to the crime scene, and he didn't take Libby's phone with him. This is something that the state has said, and the defense agrees with. Now, Richard was never on the trail at the same time as Abby and Libby. This is according to the defense. And witnesses describe a guy who is known as the bridge guy as being 5'11", which does not fit Richard's description because Richard is actually quite short, standing at about 5'4", which is a pretty big discrepancy. Now, Richard arrived to the trails around noon or 12:30 p.m., according to the defense, and he was gone from the trails by about 1:30, and that his car is gone by 2:15. And they plan to corroborate that by witness Betsy Blair, who said that she drove by the CPS lot around 2:15, and she saw one vehicle there, which was a Mercury Comet that looked the exact same as the one her dad had in the 60s. And at the time, Richard drove a 2014 Ford Focus, which is just incomparable to a Mercury Comet. They're very distinguishable. The defense points out that at about 2:05 p.m., the girls were on the bridge, and then close to halfway across the bridge, Libby was ahead of Abby, so she turned around to take that picture of Abby at 2:07. At 2:13, the abduction happens at the end of the bridge, and it's caught on video. Nobody is disagreeing that this is the time it took place. And you can't see the water or the end of the bridge in this video. It's not panoramic, so you don't see much, but you do hear a voice telling the girls to go down the hill. However, the defense points out that the man on the video, his mouth does not move. Therefore, the defense is suggesting that there's more than one person involved in this. Now, at the end of the bridge, you have a choice to either go right or left, and that they went left down a steep incline. We don't know and can't show which way they went down for sure, but either way, they would have landed on that access road to that private residence that goes under the bridge. This access road leads all the way to a home of a man named Brad Weber. Now, it's possible that there were other people or a vehicle making use of this access driveway, and evidence suggests that the girls may have gotten into a vehicle down there on that access road. There is not strong evidence about exactly what happened after the girls were forced to go down the hill, but data from Libby's phone shows that she was connected to a nearby tower and getting messages and text messages and phone calls until 5:44 p.m., at which point the phone no longer connected to that tower. Then at 4:33 a.m. the next day, Libby's phone suddenly reconnected to that tower. So the defense's theory is that this is when the phone came back into the area. After 4 p.m., when Richard Allen left, data will show that human hands handled Libby's phone. It registered human hands handling it. And this is kind of reminiscent of the Murdoch case when they were talking about the data from the phone being able to tell you when it was picked up, when it was opened, when it was used, when a passcode was used to open it, when a face was used to open it. It's just fascinating what all a phone can actually tell you. But the last ping on Libby's phone was at 5:44 p.m., and then they continue to try to ping the phone every 15 minutes. Around 10 p.m., Investigator Mullen contacted Mitch Walker at the Indiana State Police, who said that the phone wasn't in working order or was out of the service area. Well, the phone, when it was found, was in working order, so it had to be that the phone was out of service area, meaning it was not at the location in the woods. At 4:33 a.m., 15 text messages came through to Libby's phone. And the search party also, the defense claims, will establish that the girls were not where they were found, that they did a grid search, they extensively covered that area, and that the place where they were eventually found was cleared by searchers. So it'll be interesting to hear from testimony from people who were in the search party. They also, the defense points out that the girls' clothing was found in the creek. However, many people were searching the creek prior to that time, and nobody found clothes, according to the defense. The defense also points out that there will be testimony from four people who had been walking on the bridge at the time of the abduction and murder, and yet they heard nothing. These four people did not hear any screams, any talking, no rustling in the leaves, no footsteps, nothing. Now, in regards to the confessions that Richard Allen made, he made over 60 confessions, and a lot of these were kind of jumbled. I don't have the details of every single confession. What I do know, though, is that some of the confessions were proven to be inaccurate. He said things like he shot the girls in the back, but the girls were never shot. He also made confessions to killing his whole family and his grandchildren. However, his family is very much alive, and Richard Allen does not have any grandchildren. So just based on that alone...
This episode is brought to you by Polestar. There's only one true way to experience the all-electric luxury SUV Polestar 3, and that's to take a test drive. It can go from 0 to 60 in as little as 4.8 seconds with the dynamic handling of a sports car. But to truly understand how it commands the road, you need to be behind the wheel. Up to 350 miles of range, the 3D surround sound system by Bowers & Wilkins, it's all something you have to experience to believe. So book your test drive for Polestar 3 today at Polestar.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I was looking for fun ways to tell you that Mint's offer of unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month is back. So I thought it would be fun if we made $15 bills. But it turns out that's very illegal. So there goes my big idea for the commercial. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
At New Balance, we believe if you run, you're a runner, however you choose to do it. Because when you're not worried about doing things the right way, you're free to discover your way. Come and be a winner. And that's what running's all about. Run your way at newbalance.com/running.
There's room for reasonable doubt in regards to those confessions, but the defense is also pointing out that you're going to see videos of Richard Allen in his cell, or at least the jury will, in his cell where he was watched for 24 hours a day. And you're going to see the conditions that he was living in. He was apparently washing his face with toilet water. He was soaking the papers that were given to him by his lawyers in water and then eating it. He also was apparently eating his own feces, and that he went into prison with a fragile mindset to begin with, and that he apparently told his uncle early on not to send money. This was within like 2 weeks of him arriving to prison. And Richard Allen told his uncle not to send any money, not to hire a lawyer, because he was just going to admit to all of it so that they didn't have to suffer. And then 6 months after that, the confession started. And like I said, he was confessing to things that did not happen. And defense experts will say that this all has the ingredients for these to be false confessions. Now, as for the bullet, the defense keeps referring to this bullet as the magic bullet in the ground. And there was no photo or video of this bullet being recovered or retrieved at the crime scene. There was only one photo of the bullet in place and then a photo of the bullet in the lab. Now, law enforcement in this area commonly uses 40 caliber ammunition, and they also have commonly used Sig Sauer brand handguns. So it is possible that the police dropped a bullet, but nobody ever asked. And it's also possible to test law enforcement's gun against the bullet found, but nobody ever did that either. In fact, that neighbor whose access road under the bridge led to his private property, Brad Weber, he had a 40 caliber Sig Sauer in his vehicle, and this was tested and not excluded as the source of the bullet. So when you hear the state say that this was matched to Richard Allen's gun, well, sure, maybe, but it was apparently also matched to other guns, or at least other guns could not be excluded as a match. Now, in my, I don't know how many years of being a true crime podcaster, but also just someone who is interested in true crime, I have never heard of someone testing a bullet that has not been fired through a gun as matching it to someone else's gun. Like, I just have never heard that done before. So in order for them to match this bullet to Richard Allen's gun, they found markings that were apparently on this bullet that had apparently been cycled through the gun, just never actually shot out of the gun. And apparently these markings were sufficient enough to do an analysis. And what they did for the testing was they took a pristine bullet and then cycled it through Richard Allen's gun. And that process produced markings that were not sufficient for a comparison. Then they fired the bullet to try to get more markings. And once they fired the bullet, they were then able to compare the markings on the shell casing to the unfired bullet found in the ground. And based on that, that is why they're saying they can match it to Richard Allen's firearm. I don't know about you, but I am just like screaming internally that this is not science. This is not, the defense actually says it best. They're not comparing apples to apples. You're comparing apples to oranges. You can't take an unspent bullet and compare it to a spent bullet and tell me that it came from the same gun. That's just ridiculous. The science is not there. So I am very curious to see the state elaborate on this whole magic bullet theory, because to me, it just seems like the biggest reach I've seen in a long time in a trial. The defense also claims that the witness, Sarah Carbaugh, who saw the bridge guy walking on that County Road 300, looking like he had just slaughtered a pig, that her theories or her witness testimony has changed. She has once said that he looked really muddy and that he was wearing a tan jacket, and then that description changed to he looked bloody and was wearing a dark jacket. So I think they're going to try to raise reasonable doubt about her testimony. And as the defense wrapped up their opening statements, they point out that there is no DNA of Richard Allen at the crime scene. And there's also no social media connection between the girls or the scene and Richard Allen. There's no digital connection between them. There's no forensic data, nothing. Not only that, but a forensic pathologist is going to say that it looks like two different blades were used to slit the girls' throats, that one of them was serrated and one was non-serrated. And this fact, paired with the voice not matching the lips moving on the video, is all meant to imply that there was more than one person involved and that neither of those people could have been Richard Allen. Now, before I move on to the first testimonies, I want to just recap the basic structure of the timeline according to the state and the timeline according to the defense, because there are discrepancies and I'm just kind of a visual person. And so I need it very simply laid out for me. But according to the state's theory, at 1:30 p.m. on February 13th, Richard Allen allegedly arrives at the Monon High Bridge Trail. And the state claims that Allen drove an abnormal route to the CPS lot, parked there, and then headed toward the bridge. The defense claims that Richard Allen arrived at the trail earlier than the prosecution is suggesting, and that he parked his car and walked the trail, but left well before Libby and Abby were ever even dropped off. At 1:49 p.m., both sides agree that Kelsey German, Libby's older sister, dropped Libby and Abby off at the trailhead, and surveillance footage captures Kelsey's vehicle in the area. At 2:07 p.m., Libby takes the photo of Abby while they're crossing the bridge, and she posts it to Snapchat. Nobody is disputing that that is the time it was taken. And it's at about this time that they pass Betsy Blair, who is a key defense witness who described seeing a man, but her description did not match Allen. And the defense uses this to argue that Allen is not the bridge guy. Then 5 minutes later at 2:13, Libby's phone records the grainy video of the suspect known as the bridge guy walking towards them, and the man is heard instructing the girls, guys, down the hill. And the state claims that this is when Richard Allen began his assault on the girls. The only discrepancy that the defense has, however, is that the voice on the video does not match the lip movements of the suspect, suggesting that someone else was involved. And they're also pointing out that there are inconsistencies, that the person in the video cannot be Richard Allen. The defense is also presenting evidence, including surveillance footage from a local facility, that suggested Richard Allen's car was gone by 2:15. And they argue that this is crucial because it places him far from the scene when the murders occurred. Now, at this point, their timelines begin to change. According to the state, between 3:30 and 4 p.m., this is the window during which the girls were murdered. And the state theorizes that the girls were killed shortly after being led down the hill and then being left at the crime scene where they were found the next day. And they argue that Richard Allen remained in the area for a while after the murders. Then at 5:44 p.m. is the last recorded ping from Libby's phone, and the state believes that the phone remained near the crime scene from this point until the bodies were found the next day. However, what the state does not mention, and yet the defense does, is that at 4:33 a.m. the next day on February 14th, the defense points to data from Libby's phone, which reconnected to a cell tower after being out of signal range for hours. And they theorize that the phone had been moved out of the area and then brought back into the crime scene, suggesting someone else had to have been involved. Now, here are the issues that come to my mind. I don't know about you guys, but the first questions that I had were, if the state's theory is that Richard Allen tried to abduct the girls and then was interrupted during the assault, so he killed them instead, it just doesn't really make much sense to me that he would be interrupted, but he'd still have enough time to slit their throats, undress Libby and undress Abby, put Libby's clothes onto Abby, and then leave the scene. That just doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. If he was interrupted and in a hurry, then how could he have had time to do all these other things and then stage the scene to look like this Odinistic ritual with the sticks laying on top of the girls, which is something we can talk about later. But it just doesn't make sense to me that if someone was moving with haste because he had been interrupted, that he still would have had time to do all these other things while not completing his mission, which was to sexually assault the girls, which is what what the state is implying. Oh, and by the way, during this entire assault, Richard Allen manages to leave absolutely zero of his DNA at the scene. That is a red flag to me. But I promise I'm trying to keep an open mind throughout this. I mean, there's obviously a whole trial to go and lots of evidence is going to come forward. So we'll let the evidence speak for itself. But those are the main issues that I have after the opening statements. And as far as the defense implying that someone else had to have done this or implying that it was more than one person who did this, they don't even have to name who they think it was. All they have to do is place doubt in the jury's mind that it could have been Richard Allen. If there's any doubt that Richard Allen was involved, then they have to acquit. It is up to the state to prove without a reasonable doubt that Richard Allen is culpable for this crime. So when you think about it in that context, the state really has its work cut out for them. And I'm just kind of surprised that they are going this far without any DNA evidence and this unspent bullet, which wasn't even the murder weapon. There's no murder weapon even found. I just think that the state is up against it. So moving on, the opening statements took up the first portion of the day, and then they went into witness testimonies. And the first person that they brought to the stand was Becky Patty, who is Libby German's grandmother. Becky Patty described Libby as very smart and that she participated in the math bowl and was active in swimming and volleyball and softball and soccer, and that Libby had many sleepovers with friends and vice versa. And Becky told the jury that Abby Williams went on spring break with her and her husband and Libby. So this is a very close friendship. Becky said that Libby had just turned 14 the previous December in 2016, and that her sister Kelsey, having her driver's license, helped out with all of Libby's activities. Becky then told the jury that on February 13th, it was a typical work day, but that school was out and that Abby had spent the night on Sunday. So she told the girls if they filed some paperwork for her, she would pay them. Becky began to cry as she described Libby and Abby asking to go to the trails. And she tells the jury that the last thing Abby said to her was, "Grandma, I will be okay." And then she encouraged them to bring a coat to the trails. She also described Libby as wearing gray sweats and a tie-dye shirt with Nike shoes, and that Libby loved photography and loved the Monon High Bridge. And that Libby was not the type of person to lie about where she was going. If Libby said she was going to the trail, that is where she was going to be. The prosecution asked Becky if it was a concern of hers to know what time Abby and Libby would be picked up from the trail. And Becky responded that she always coordinated with us. She told the prosecution that they took the girls to the trail at about 1:30 p.m. Becky Patty told prosecutors that she herself had not been to the bridge, but all of her kids had gone there to take photos, and that she didn't realize how high it was.
She said Libby was polite, but that if you were out of line, she did not have a hard time telling you. And she also told the jury that Libby loved crime shows and had a great intuition. Becky Patty told the jury that at 3:30 p.m. that day, Derek German, who was Libby's dad, called to say that they had not heard from Libby and that they decided to start looking at the trails. They checked both directions that they could have walked and did not see them. They called AT&T and could not ping Libby's phone. She said Libby was scared of the dark and it was after 5 p.m. at that point and she felt like they just needed to call the police. So she tried to get a hold of Abby's mom but was unable to. And then Becky told her or told the jury that her husband, Mike, then called the police. Becky told the jury that the search continued the next morning and a friend came up to her and said, "They found them. They found them." She told the friend, "You need to take me to Libby." The defense then asked Becky, "Did you provide your DNA to police 2 days ago?" And Becky Patty responded, quote, "Yes, one of the times," end quote. The prosecution asked Becky, "Do you know if Libby had ever been exposed to handguns?" And she responded, "I don't know. My husband has a few guns. He hunts. She had not been around handguns. Nobody in her house owns handguns." So I think that they're just trying to lay the foundation for the DNA in regards to this piece of hair and then the exposure to handguns, possibly because of this bullet that was found. The next witness was Kelsey German, who is Libby's older sister. And Kelsey told the jury that Libby wanted her to go with her to the trails, but that Kelsey couldn't go. So she told Libby that she would drop them off if they had a ride home. She also told the jury that Abby wore a gray zip-up jacket that day that she had borrowed from Kelsey. Kelsey was shown a photo by the prosecution of Abby and Libby inside Kelsey's car, and jurors were given a copy of that as well. Kelsey was asked to stand up and show on a large map how she would have taken the girls to the trails, and Kelsey said she dropped the girls off and then went to her boyfriend's house. Kelsey then told the jury that she eventually got a call from Becky Patty that Libby was missing while her boyfriend had just left for work. The prosecution showed a closer view of the earlier map that Kelsey explained that lots of people at school go on this, referring to the trails that are near the bridge. And Kelsey was asked if she was aware that it was private property, and she said no and laughed. Kelsey then told the jury that she communicated with Libby via Snapchat for the most part. And Kelsey described the bridge to the jury as different than it was in 2017. And then she went on to describe the changes that have taken place to the jury. The prosecution asked Kelsey, "If you were at the end of the bridge, could you see someone at the beginning of it?" And Kelsey answered no, which I do believe because this is a very long bridge. If you Google a picture of it, it looks very, very long. Kelsey told the jury about Snapchat and the texting feature and discussed timestamps on Snapchat stories. And then Kelsey said she was texting and calling Libby the night of February 13th and then described how she became emotional after finding out that the girls had been found and yet at the time didn't know that they had died. Then the defense asked Kelsey if she had worn the sweatshirt that was worn by Abby, and Kelsey said that they had washed it before, but they had not worn it. Then the prosecution called Derek German to the stand, and Derek is Liberty's father. And Derek told the jury that he lived in the home with the Patties, who are Libby's grandparents, with Libby and her sister Kelsey. Derek told the jury that he communicated with Libby via text and took her to Abby's house a lot. Derek said he picked Abby up for a sleepover the night before and then made banana pancakes for their breakfast on February 13th. Derek told the jury he left home at about 1:20 p.m. to take photos for appraisal properties in Frankfurt owned by the Patties. Halfway there, Libby called him to pick him up from the bridge, and Derek told Libby he had photos to take and he finished the work and then went to pick up the girls. But he also mentioned that it would be a couple hours before he would be able to pick them up. Derek told the jury he called Libby to tell her to come back to the entrance to the park, but she never answered. And then he told the jury he ran into a man and asked if he had seen two teenage girls, and the man said no. Derek then went to the water and to the Freedom Bridge. He told the jury he continued to call Libby's phone and began yelling their names. Prosecutors asked Derek to show on a map where he searched, and he tells the jury others were searching south of him. He told the jury he parked at the CPS building and went back to the entrance. Derek then told the jury that the next day during the search, quote, "I just heard Mom," who is Becky Patty, "screaming," and that then he, quote, "saw the coroner go by and about 12 cop cars, so he just knew." The last person to be called to the stand that day was Deputy Mitchell Cutrone at the Carroll County Sheriff's Office. He was the first law enforcement officer to the trails to help search for the girls, and he described searching the property of Brad Weber near the trails, and that Weber told Cutrone he could search the area and he was not bloody or sweaty. So that wraps up the first official day of the trial, and then they picked right back up on Saturday from 9 to about noon. The first witness called to the stand by the prosecution was Steve Mullen, who served as Delphi's chief of police in 2017, and he was on duty the day of the murders. He described on February 13th that it was a routine day and spoke about hearing radio traffic and receiving texts about two girls missing. During his testimony, he stood up and approached a map of the trail on a TV and pointed out where Abby and Libby entered. After learning the girls did not return, he said he contacted Delphi Middle School and spoke with the search party. He did not participate in the search, but he said that he stayed behind at dispatch. He then said that he left dispatch at around 2 a.m. on February 14th, and he told the court he did not believe anyone had hurt the girls and believed that at that point that they would still return home. He returned to work at 7:30 the next day, this would be February 14th, and met with the search party. He said he did not direct them where to go. He continued his testimony by describing when he heard that the girls were found and noting on the courtroom map exactly where they were located. He said he met with Abby and Libby's families around 2 p.m. to say that they had found the bodies and were working on identification. Then Steve Mullen says that he learned of a store near the start of the trail, the Hoosier Harvest Store, and that it had security cameras. The store's cameras pointed towards the 300 North and West, the County Road 300. This is where that one witness, Sarah Carbaugh, said that she saw the bridge guy walking after apparently the murders took place. He reviewed footage from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on February 13th, and he also discussed drone footage taken of the trail on February 13th of 2024, which State Prosecutor Nick McClelland said was to represent and compare what the two scenes looked like 7 years apart. Defense Attorney Andrew Baldwin then began questioning Steve Mullen, starting by asking about improvements that had been made on the trail since 2017, and that is when the judge chimed in, asking about the thought process behind searching for the girls downstream. And Steve Mullen said that this was in case the girls might have fallen off the bridge. And I mentioned to you guys how it would be very easy to do that. Then Andrew Baldwin asked if Mullins went to the scene, and Mullen said he did not. Now, backing up a little bit to the morning that the girls were found, Steve Mullen said that he gave his phone number and instructions to searchers at a fire station in downtown Delphi. And among the searchers was another lifelong Delphi resident, Patrick Brown, who had called off work on February 14th to help search for the girls. Brown said during Saturday's third and final testimony that he was a longtime friend of Libby's grandfather, Mike Patty, and had learned that the two girls were missing from a Facebook post made by Mike's wife the previous night. Among those searching along with him was Jake Johns. John said that his wife had come home and told him that the girls were missing, and the next day his boss at Pearson's, which is a propane delivery company in Delphi, asked if he and a coworker would be willing to help with the search, and that he was like, absolutely, we will. So Jacob John said he had never heard of the Monon High Bridge. He and his colleague then parked at Riley Park, which is just south of downtown, around 8:30 a.m. Saturday, and then walked upstream to the east, along the southern bank of Deer Creek. It took them nearly 4 hours to reach the high bridge, he said. And then after passing the bridge, Jacob John said he saw a flash of yellow, pink, and blue against the otherwise barren February landscape, and that Libby's tie-dye shirt was caught on branches in the water near the creek's northern bank. He said, looking toward the Monon High Bridge, that you could see where the rocks and dirt had been disturbed, and he also noted shoe prints his colleague saw during the search. Jake Johns was actually the second person to testify that Saturday, and he said that after he spotted that tie-dye shirt, he also located a pair of black Nike shoes that belonged to Libby. Soon after, a person living on the other side of the creek was called to come down to the search area. Brad German and Kelsey also arrived at that time, and that's when Johns said another member of the search party said, "We have found the bodies." But Jake Johns says he did not personally see the bodies. Then we heard from Pat Brown, who was a witness for the state. And Pat Brown's home is about a mile and a half from the High Bridge, and he participated in the search efforts on February 14th. He told the jury that he had known Libby's grandfather, Mike, since high school and also knew Libby. And he said he was at home eating dinner and watching TV when his wife told him that Libby and Abby went missing. Pat Brown said he called a man named Tom Mears for help and went out in the dark to search for the girls. The next day, February 14th, he said that he called off work to go help with the search and that he and Mears drove into town where Pat Brown said that Delphi Police Chief Steve Mullins was, quote, heading the search up. However, earlier that day, Steve Mullins testified that he did not head up the search, so that's a little discrepancy. Pat Brown went on to say that he picked up his daughter around 11 a.m. on February 14th and then soon received a call from Mears to say that they'd found Libby's shirt along Deer Creek. So then Brown went to the north side of the creek and found the girls' bodies on the way. He choked up as he testified that at first he thought that they were mannequins before realizing that they had found the girls. At that point, Melissa, who was a relative of the Patties, was with Pat Brown when they spotted the girls, so she ran off to call the police, and then Pat Brown noted on the courtroom map where he found the girls and said that he got within 5 feet of their bodies, and then once he realized it was them, he turned his back to the bodies, never going closer than that, until police arrived on the scene. Defense attorney Andrew Baldwin then questioned Pat Brown, focusing on the sound of voices, what could be heard, and if Pat Brown had cell service while he was in the woods. And then the judge also asked questions about Brown's cell phone or cell service provider and how long it took for police to arrive after they found the girls, and also how long it took for the scene to be secured. So I'm sure that they're trying to establish if cell phone service was available in that specific area where the girls were found, but the judge is trying to clarify if they even have the same provider, because not all providers cover the same area, obviously. After this, jurors were then shown a photograph of Libby's shirt and shoes in the muddy water of Deer Creek, and this is a picture that you can find on Google. And I think for many, it will beg the question how it took that long for anyone to find that when it was so close to the place where the girls were last seen on the bridge. And I guess what I would like to see is the state provide some sort of evidence about where the search party exactly took place. Because if the search party did cover those areas prior to those things being found, then that would suggest that they arrived at that spot after the search took place, which would only bolster the defense's theory. So I'm really interested in the coming days. I'm going to follow this as closely as I can. I will try to intermingle some of these episodes with the ones that I've already got planned. We've actually got episodes planned through November. So these are just going to be dropping sporadically. I don't really have a time frame. I'm just going to try to keep up as much as I can with four kids at home. But thankfully, there are a lot of people who are following this case, who are showing up at the trial, and they're sharing their notes. And so there is a lot of information out there. I'm going to try to weed through it so that I can, you know, put it all out there concisely, chronologically, easily for you to understand, and in less than an hour. So that is the recap for the first week, which is really only like the first day and a half of trial and testimonies. But next week, I will try to recap what's going on as far as October 21st through the 26th. So stay tuned for that. We'll see what happens. Thanks for listening. Mama Mystery out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love
love finance again.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.